Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I sat down with Ian Millhiser, who is the justice editor at Think Progress, and we discussed the court system, the Supreme Court, and how that all ties back into this policy of family separation.
The Trump administration's argument in the Muslim ban cases is essentially that the border is a civil rights free zone. Like whatever civil rights you might have, if you are a non-citizen who wants to cross into the United States, those civil rights cease, and like the courts aren't allowed to examine what the government's doing. The government can basically do whatever it wants. And so that obviously has, even though the Muslim ban is distinct from what Trump is doing right now with family separations, like if the courts agree with him that the border is a civil rights free zone, that has terrible implications for everything he wants to do on immigration.
So it's a long interview and we talked for a while, but I think it's really important to understand the court's role in both this issue and other appalling Trump policies moving forward. So I'm not going to take too much time here. I'm going to say a quick Hellion of the week and be done with it. So I just want to first say that I've been wondering why Jeff Sessions had stayed the attorney general. You know, with all the insults and for all the vitriol pointed at him, I thought he would have been fired or left by now. But it's obvious now that just like Scott Pruitt, who has been kept on in the midst of corruption scandal after corruption scandal, he's doing what he was hired to do. He is dismantling policies that protect our environment as the head of the EPA. And so Sessions is in a similar situation. Sure, Trump wishes that he hadn't recused himself from the Russia investigation. But more important than that, Sessions has become the figurehead. Him and Kirstjen Nielsen, who Trump also didn't like, but they've taken the position of figureheads of this policy of separating families at the border. And Sessions, as I discussed with Ian, has an important role going forward in making sure that these policies stay in place. And I won't spoil too much, but basically, in order to give teeth to the executive order that he signed, which is bullshit and does nothing for the 2,300 kids that are already separated from their parents and does not end the bullshit zero tolerance policy that started this whole fucking mess, he wants Sessions to and the DOJ to go back and revisit something called the Flores settlement. The Flores settlement says that you can only hold minors for 20 days. And under Trump's executive order, he wants to hold minors with their families indefinitely. So there's going to be a very important and specific role for Sessions moving forward. So for the Hellion this week, there are a lot of options. And one that I wanted to actually highlight that I will do very quickly are four NFL players. So Trump had asked NFL players for the names of potential people for him to pardon, because apparently he's just playing with his pardon power all over. So four NFL players, Doug Baldwin, Malcolm Jenkins, Benjamin Watson, and Anquan Boldin, Boldin is actually retired, wrote an op-ed. And they said, quote, "A handful of pardons will not address the sort of systemic injustice that the NFL players have been protesting. These are problems that our government has created, many of which occur at the local level. If President Trump thinks he can end these injustices, if we deliver him a few names, he hasn't been listening to us." And obviously this comes in the midst of the NFL protests and the NFL saying that they will fine any players that kneel during the national anthem. And it's a really powerful statement for them to say to the president, you're full of shit. And if you think that throwing a couple of pardons at us and asking us for some names is going to fix the problem, is going to fix what we've been protesting, then you're out of your damn fucking mind. And I just really appreciate that courage and the use of their platform in that way. So they are definitely Hellions of the Week. And another person that I want to talk about is Rachel Maddow. On Tuesday night, I believe, at the very end of the show, the AP broke news that babies and toddlers were being taken to tender age facilities. And tender age is just small children. And when she got the news, she broke down crying. And Rachel Maddow, I think, as we all know, is a personal hero of mine. And I've been watching her for years, and I've never really seen her break laughing. I mean, it happens, but she's usually very measured on screen. And so to see her cry, which I've never seen before, really showed a human side to news media and to the people who are entrenched in this news day after day after day. As someone who willingly, you know, takes in as much of this news as possible and, you know, to really understand what's going on, to really convey it properly, it can be so overwhelming. And especially on TV, when you have these veterans and these practice news anchors who are so good at keeping it together that sometimes it feels like I'm just failing because it's so overwhelming. You know, here at Hellbent, we pride ourselves on being vulnerable and opening up about what's difficult and you know, give the news that feminist lens that allows us to express how the news is affecting us directly. And just so seeing that and seeing that nakedness was really moving for me. And Rachel Maddow is always my Hellion, but this week in particular. Our guest today is Ian Millhiser. Ian is the justice editor for Think Progress and the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. That is one hell of a title. So, Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Happy to have you. So I want to jump right in and ask you about a few recent Supreme Court decisions. I specifically want to ask about Piera versus Sessions and DiMaia versus Sessions. So can you explain what these are and how they tie in to other immigration policies, such as this family separation policy going on at the border?
Sure. So like the actual issue that the court decided in those cases is very narrow and like just a very routine, like one dealt with which immigrants could be deported after they commit certain crimes. Another one dealt with you have certain protections against or potential protections against being deported if you've been in the country for 10 years. And it just dealt with like at what like when does that 10 year period stop? When does it cut off? And so these aren't huge earth-shattering cases that will reshape the, you know, our constitution or even that much about our immigration law. But in both cases, you had conservative justices who went on a tear about basically how they think the courts don't have enough power. And they think that in this time when Republicans have captured the judiciary, stolen the Gorsuch seat on the Supreme Court, and seem very likely to hold on to the Supreme Court for a very long time, they want to transfer a lot of power that historically has been held by members of the executive branch, which is at least a branch where we can throw the head of it out if we don't like that person, and transfer that power to themselves. And it, you know, it's one of the many ways I think you are seeing Republicans, they want to use this brief moment of time where they're in power to try to entrench their rule so that even if a Democrat wins in 2020, it'll be very difficult for that Democrat to govern and Republicans will still be steering the ship.
So the scope and limitations of the judicial branch's power comes from a case called Chevron and the Chevron Doctrine. Can you give us kind of a one-sentence example of what the Chevron Doctrine is?
I think my short answer to that is no, because it's such a complicated. Let me give you an example. So the Clean Air Act, which is one of the primary laws that the EPA is charged with enforcing, says that certain power plants have to continuously update their systems to make sure that they're using the best technology that's presently available to reduce emissions. And the EPA will frequently promulgate new regulations, which just update what the technology is. The EPA studies what the cutting edge technology is. They determine what right now is the best thing we can do to reduce emissions, which is going to be better than it was 10 years ago, which was better than it was 20 years ago. And so they're constantly issuing regulations, updating what these power plants have to do. And there's just a whole lot of statutes that work this way, a whole lot of laws where they say, Congress says, here's what we want to accomplish, and then delegates to an agency the job of filling in the detail of how that thing will be accomplished and updating the rules as, you know, new developments come along. Chevron says when there's uncertainty about whether the law allows an agency to do what it just did, that uncertainty will generally be resolved in the agency's favor. So if the EPA says that, hey, we think this is the best way to reduce emissions, and a judge disagrees, generally the judge is supposed to defer to EPA's judgment. And there's lots of reasons for this, because EPA knows more about environmental policy than judges do. It's, again, because EPA is led by someone who's appointed by a president who can be thrown out of office in the next election, and judges sit for life. And so that's how things have been since the 1980s. Gorsuch, going back to when he was a lower court judge, has wanted to get rid of this doctrine. It's called the Chevron doctrine, and say, no. When there's uncertainty, court should resolve it. Court should decide, like, what the emissions regulation should be, or who gets overtime pay, or what the rules should be governing people who manage retirement funds, to take three recent cases that have been percolating their way through the courts. Courts should get to decide whether or not the agency has exceeded their power. And as a practical matter, he would give the Supreme Court a veto over many of these decisions. He'd do it at a time when Republicans control the court. And the scary thing that happened today, I know this has been a very long explanation after you asked for one sentence.
It's okay.
but the scary thing that happened today is that Justice Anthony Kennedy, who, of course, is supposed to be the swing vote on the Supreme Court, handed down an opinion suggesting that he's on board with what Gorsuch wants to do.
Okay.
And so that's the long explanation, that a lot of these questions about our environmental regulation, our labor regulation, all of these questions that historically have been decided by federal agencies where we can throw the person in charge of them out of power, will now potentially be decided by unelected judges.
Gotcha. Okay. So basically putting power, Gorsuch is arguing, or judges are arguing, that they want to put more power into the courts, which are, you know, it's an unelected lifetime appointment, versus putting more power into these agencies and the executive branch, which is subject to democracy voting cycles.
Exactly.
Got it.
And it fits into this broader pattern. I mean, part of the reason why this would be so devastating if it happens is because, you know, the other big cases that the Supreme Court did not decide this term, even though we all thought they were going to, was the gerrymandering cases. And what gerrymandering means is that, I mean, maybe Trump has managed to screw things up so badly that the impossible is going to happen in November. But, like, the House is so gerrymandered that under normal circumstances, it is extraordinarily difficult for Democrats to control the House. Right. And so if Democrats can't capture the House, and if they can't use agencies to regulate, that means it doesn't matter who's in the White House.
Right.
Because, you know, you can elect a Democrat, but they can't pass a law, because Republicans will have a lock on the House. They can't use the authority they have as the head of the executive, because the Supreme Court said, oh, no, that's not your power anymore. That's our power now.
Right.
And so all of this works together to create a world where, you know, I mean, we'll still have the trappings of elections in this country. And, like, sometimes the president will probably be a Democrat, but that president won't actually have any power when there's a Democrat in the White House.
Right. I mean, I feel like you could see this in the Senate, not necessarily in the House, with McConnell basically stealing the Supreme Court seat from Obama. That's why they
wanted it so bad. Right. You know the conversation we would be having right now if Merrick Garland, if Obama's last Supreme Court nominee had been confirmed, instead of having this conversation right now, we would be all but certain that the Muslim ban was being struck down. The case that came up earlier this term involving whether if you have a religious justification for discrimination, you're allowed to do it. Court wouldn't have even bothered with that case. Gerrymandering would be unconstitutional. And like the conversation we would be having right now is, oh, well, it's nice that Roe v. Wade is going to start expanding again. The conversation we'd have right now is, would be about how do we get rid of these terrible sexual harassment decisions that Justice Alito wrote when Republicans had the majority. Completely different conversation. But instead, we have to talk about whether or not we're going to have a democracy.
Right. Well, and to that end, I want to ask you a little bit about how this all ties in, the Muslim ban and this family separation policy. You know, you wrote about Trump versus Hawaii, which was the case that struck down the Muslim ban. It said, quote, aliens outside the United States seeking a visa or initial admission have no constitutional rights at all regarding entry into this country. And that was the government's position. So it really seems like this administration has been telegraphing these kind of policies and this policy of potential family separation for quite some time. Do you think that this case, the Muslim ban case, is going to be is going to foreshadow some of what is going on with the family separation policies?
Yeah. So that's my fear. And I have two, I guess, related fears. I mean, one is, like you said, the Trump administration's argument in the Muslim ban cases is essentially that the border is a civil rights free zone. Like whatever civil rights you might have, if you are a non-citizen who wants to cross into the United States, those civil rights cease, and like the courts aren't allowed to examine what the government's doing. The government can basically do whatever it wants.
Right.
And so that obviously has, even though the Muslim ban is distinct from what Trump is doing right now with family separations, like if the courts agree with him that the border is a civil rights free zone, that has terrible implications for everything he wants to do on immigration. But the other thing that worries me is like Supreme Court decisions aren't just legal decisions. They're cultural artifacts.
Right.
Like people react to them and they overread them and they drive the zeitgeist of the nation. I mean, one thing that I wrote about this morning was this case from 1940 called Gobitis.
Right.
And Gobitis involved two children. They were Jehovah's Witnesses. They were expelled from their public school because their faith told them that they couldn't participate in the Pledge of Allegiance. They refused to participate in the Pledge of Allegiance, were kicked out of school because of it. And after that decision, which, you know, was a bad decision, but was also only focused on that narrow question, you know, can you force someone to say the Pledge of Allegiance in school? Led to this massive backlash against Jehovah's Witnesses. There were literally thousands of incidents of people being beaten, of people being dragged through the streets, people being harassed, police bringing frivolous arrests against Jehovah's Witnesses. There was at least one incident where a mob set upon a group of Jehovah's Witnesses, beat them to the point that they needed medical attention, and then the police arrested them and questioned them for hours and wouldn't let them leave so they could get medical attention. And the Supreme Court didn't say, oh yeah, you should do all that.
Right.
But the signal the court sent when it said, you know, like, we're not really sure if this little disfavored group here deserves our protection.
Right.
You know, people read it in a really dangerous way. And if there is one person who is going to read, you know, a relatively narrow opinion dealing with one issue and treat it as a license to do whatever he wants, it's Donald Trump.
Right. Well, this was actually the discussion I had the other week with Imani Gandhi about the Masterpiece Cake Shop and how it's a very narrow decision, yep. but people are now looking at it as some sort of zeitgeist to then discriminate on religious basis. So basically what you're saying is that the Supreme Court, their rulings are not abstract or theoretical, really, because they're so well known. They're read by the nation, that they have real life societal and cultural implications.
Right. I mean, they have real cultural implications. And then they also just change the way that public officials act.
Right.
I mean, 10 years ago, the idea that you could just refuse to follow an anti-discrimination law was considered ridiculous.
Right.
In fact, this issue came up when the ban on whites-only lunch counters was signed into law. And there was a business owner who said, well, God wants me to only serve white people. And the Supreme Court said, no, that is a frivolous claim that you're bringing.
Right.
You know, don't even bother us with that. And so, like, if I'm, you know, whether I'm like an activist or a business owner or a lawmaker who agrees with the view that, like, if you identify with the religious right, you shouldn't have to follow certain laws, I'm going to start pushing the envelope right now.
Sure.
Because even though the court didn't say explicitly I can do that, they took a claim that should have been a nothing burger that was thrown out of court at a very early stage and took it very, very seriously. And that signals to me, oh, the ground under my feet is changing. Let's see what I can get away with now.
Right. And so this – so a lot of people are speaking to the courts, or they're having this discussion that the courts are kind of the last line of defense against these sort of policies, against the Muslim ban, against family separation, against voter suppression and the disintegration of civil rights. And with the markedly more conservative judicial branch and the continuation of McConnell's plan to pack the courts with the most fringe conservatives he could think of, are these policies like family separation in peril of being reinforced by our courts?
I mean, that's – I think there's – terrible peril of that. I mean, we will know. I mean, right now there's only two more decision days on the court's calendar before they go on their summer vacation. So we will know either tomorrow or Monday what happens in the Muslim ban case. And if the court upholds the Muslim ban, they will be sending as loud a signal as they possibly can that the courts are not going to save you from Donald Trump. You know, I mean, like, the facts of the Muslim ban case are Donald Trump said, I want to ban Muslims, which is unconstitutional. You can't signal people out that way because of their religion. And then someone told him, hey, you can't say that, dude. And he went on TV and says, hey, people are saying I can't say this, so I'm going to stop saying it. And instead, what I'm going to start saying is that I'm going to ban people from certain countries because that's okay. And then his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, went on TV and said, oh, yeah, we told Trump that he asked us find a legal way to ban Muslims. And we told him, oh, the way to do it is to ban countries. Don't call it a Muslim ban. Call it a territory ban. And then Trump did the very thing that he said he would do.
Right.
So, do
the courts take Trump's state of mind or his intention into consideration when deciding these cases?
Right. And that's normally a difficult question.
Sure.
So, like, this comes up a lot in, like, race discrimination cases.
Sure.
Where, like, someone is fired and the question is, like, well, did the boss have racist intent when they did that? But, like, this isn't a case where you have to probe – where you have to have ESP to figure out what happened. I mean,
this is
a case where Donald Trump said, hey, guys, I'm going to violate the Constitution, and here's how I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And then he did it.
Right, right.
So, like, if the courts aren't going to strike that down
–
what are they there for? I mean, you know, if they're not going to say that you can't brag about how you're going to break the law and then break the law in the exact same way you said you were going to do it, then we just can't rely on them.
Right, right. To use Giuliani's new favorite term, now we have a kangaroo court. So I want to ask you specifically about this family separation policy, again, taking a sort of broader view of the court's role in this. And the executive order that Donald Trump signed, that he's taking a big victory lap on, is basically saying that they want to detain families together. But there's something called the Flores settlement that says you can't detain children for more than 20 days. So it seems like this executive order lacks the teeth it needs to actually end family separation and actually propagate a system in which children are not being detained. So can you explain the Flores settlement and how it sort of plays into this?
Sure. So Flores, I mean, this goes all the way back to the 1980s. So beginning in the 80s, there were allegations that immigration officials were, you know, mistreating immigrants, detaining children, you know, doing all kinds of terrible things. And this litigation went on for a really long time. It went up to the Supreme Court at some point. And finally, in 1997, there was this settlement. And the terms of the settlement are that after, and it doesn't actually say 20 days, although judges have later interpreted the settlement to say, like, yeah, if it's more than 20 days, that's a problem. Yeah. But, like, after a reasonable amount of time, you have to release children who are in detention. Right. There are regulations implementing the Flores settlement, and those regulations say that the government always has the option to also release the parent.
Got it.
So the Trump administration is under no, like, you know, the way to keep the families together, it says right there in the Code of Federal Regulations how you do it. You just let the parent go too, and you can put an anklet on them that so you can keep track of them, or you can have some other mechanism to make sure that they'll actually show up for their court date in a future date. But they're not required to hold these people in detention, and it's actually a waste of resources. Right. I mean, we have GPS now. There's very good ways that you can know where someone is. So if they really wanted to solve this problem, that's what they would do.
Right.
What they've done instead is, so what this executive order says, it has this vague statement that it will be the policy of this administration that children should not be separated. And then they said that, like, the only really new thing in that order is that Trump ordered the attorney general to go back to the court that heard the Flores case and ask for the settlement to be modified so that kids can be locked up now.
Oh, they want to revisit Flores.
Right. So the solution that they want is not, we'll let the parents out with the kids, we'll put an ankle bracelet on the kid, on the parent, and then we'll know where everyone is. The solution that the Trump administration wants is, oh, we'll just keep the kids in jail too.
Right.
But at least they'll be in the same jail.
Got it. Well, and I was also reading up a little bit on the Flores settlement, and in the Flores settlement, it actually stipulates that minors kept in federal custody, quote, are placed in the least restrictive conditions possible and to be provided with some basic necessities like food and water,
right,
access to medical treatment, access to running water, and that they be separated from adults whom they had no relation. I mean, I feel like I'm a little disgusted that our courts had to stipulate that people deserve water and medical treatment.
Right.
So, I mean, so is revisiting Flores a bad idea? Like, is this going to kind of remove the protections that are already locked in place with it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no good reason to revisit it at this point. I mean, part of the reason we're having this situation where, like, you know, you have these kids in, like, giant cages in the middle of an abandoned Walmart.
Right.
Part of the reason you have this situation. So, like, imagine you had a society that has no laws, you know, no laws at all. And then you decide that, hey, let's have some laws. So, like, let's ban murder and let's ban theft and let's ban some other things. And if, you know, you decide to, if someone commits these crimes, we're going to decide that we're going to put them in jail. Well, you know what you're going to have to do if you pass those laws? You have to build a jail.
Right.
Like, you're going to have to actually have physical facilities that are adequate to the purpose that you're trying to serve here. And what has happened with the Trump administration's immigration policy? I mean, the previous administrations had done, like, less systematic versions of this. But, like, this no-tolerance policy where everyone who crosses, unless they come in through a border checkpoint, you know, we're going to arrest them, we're going to charge them with a crime, we're going to detain them, we're going to, you know, up until recently, we're going to separate the kids from the parents. Like, we just don't have the infrastructure for that. Like, we hadn't built the detention facilities for it. We hadn't thought through the logistical questions, like, how do we get and make sure they have enough food? How do we make sure that the babies have diapers? Because apparently that's a concern now. We hadn't built, you know, not that I think we should build this logistical infrastructure, right. But like the reason why the whole thing looks like a goddamn clusterfuck. Right. Is because they just decided to start doing this without thinking about, like, okay, if we're going to do this, right. Like, what sort of preparation do we need?
Right. Right. So we don't have that underlying infrastructure. I have another question, though. When the court, when the Supreme Court or any other lower court basically revisits a law and makes a judgment on it and changes it in some way. Is it then up to Congress, like you said, to build the underlying infrastructure, right. To fund it, to rework existing laws that were built around it? Like, how does that work? This is more of like an existential, like, I don't understand the legal system well right. enough. But I mean, I feel like, especially when you have these pillar cases or pillar decisions that other laws are built around, like, how does that even work?
Gotcha. So I mean, it's a really good question. So as a general rule, federal courts can only say no to things. There are a few exceptions to this. Right. But like as a general rule, like when the court finds something unconstitutional, they'll strike the law down and then they'll go back and then they'll what they're essentially saying to Congress is this didn't work. Try again with another.
Got
law.
It.
I mean, like there are rare circumstances and they mostly arise in the equal protection context where like, you know, so if like the federal government said, we're going to provide a $100 check for every white person, that would be unconstitutional because you can't discriminate on the basis of race. And the remedy would be that the courts would order that non-white people also have to get the $100 check. So like it, yeah, so in that, but most of the time, the courts just say no to things. They say you have to stop doing something. So the answer to your question is like most of the time, like it's up to Congress then to figure out what it wants to replace the thing that was struck down with.
Right. And then with something like something that's time sensitive, like family separation, like the Muslim ban, the court will often say it has to be done within this span of time, right. Or if they say yes, you can continue doing this, but there's no, like you said, underlying infrastructure to deal with this clusterfuck. Is it then up to Congress to say, okay, they said we can do this, and now we have to figure out the financial framework for it?
Right. So, I mean, what the courts potentially could do, and I mean, again, like I see no reason to alter the Flores settlement. I mean, I think the solution here is that you treat people like human beings and don't look for reasons to throw them in a detention center.
Weird.
But like, yeah, imagine that. But like one thing they could do if the courts were to say that, well, you know, the problem here is just that there isn't adequate facilities for all these people, is like this came up in California's system. So California just had like massive prison overcrowding where like the pictures are shocking, where you see like bunks stacked three high in these huge gymnasiums and every corner has a body in it. And the Supreme Court eventually said, no, like this is not acceptable. You have to reduce the number of people you have in your prisons, or, you know, conceivably they could have built more prisons.
Right.
I could imagine the courts could possibly come up with an arrangement like that. But I mean, the California litigation went on for years and years and years and years, and it involved, you know, hundreds of pages of fact finding and multiple hearings. And you know, the problem that we have is that the problem is now. Like there are 2,000 kids right now who don't know where their mommy and daddy are.
Right.
And it's not clear that the government knows where their mommy and daddy are either.
Right. We don't have 3 years to fuck around with this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, this isn't something where like you find a good district judge and he holds a bunch of hearings, or she holds a bunch of hearings and like, you know, you do discovery and stuff like
right.
that. Like, you know, this is something you need to deal with right now.
Right. Do you think that the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on this issue?
I think it's likely that it eventually winds up at the Supreme Court. So, I mean, just like, you know, I guess your basic introduction to federal civil procedure is that most cases start in what's called the district court, which is, you know, a single judge, and then that goes to the U.S. Court of Appeals, and then that would then go to the Supreme Court. And it can take, I mean, it, if for something that requires a full trial, it can take years to go through the district courts. I mean, even, you know, even something that's expedited generally takes weeks, and then, you know, and then it can take much more time at each level. So I could see this going to the Supreme Court at some point, but it might take so much time that, like, by the time that it gets hopefully by the time the court gets its hands on it, the issue will be moot because Donald Trump will no longer be president, and the next president will have ceased the abhorrent behavior that's at the heart of the lawsuit.
Yeah, I remember that the Supreme Court said something similar about the Muslim ban back in October, and they were like, when we revisit this, hopefully this isn't an issue anymore, and it ends up that it was.
Right.
I have two more questions for you. First one is sure. An existential question that I've been wondering about. So it's my understanding that judges were originally conceived to be objective figures, or at the very least neutral. And now we have phrases right. such as Republican judge or liberal justice, and they seem to right. be the norm. Is this a new phenomenon, or just it's cast in sharp relief?
I mean, this is actually what my book is about, is that, you know, the Supreme Court's almost always been terrible. you go back 100 years, almost 100 years to the day, I think like 100 years as of last Sunday, the Supreme Court handed down a decision called Hammer v. Dagenhart, which struck down child labor laws. Mm-hmm. Said that the federal government couldn't ban 6-year-olds from working in factories.
Wow.
I think most of your listeners, Separate But Equal was a creation of the Supreme Court.
Right.
The Supreme Court's been pretty horrible for most of its career. I think what is different now is this is the first era I can think of where ideology has aligned with partisanship
okay.
in the way that it does now. So, like, it used to be the case that, like, Democrats would appoint some justices, Republicans would appoint some justices, and for most of the court's history, a majority of them were just terrible.
They were just dickheads, yeah.
You know, right. Like, now it's the case that Republicans want one very clear set of things out of the judiciary, and Democrats want something different. And when Republicans have a majority on the Supreme Court, you can expect the Republican agenda to be written into judicial opinions. And that is new. Like, I can't think of any other point in American history where the court has been as partisan as it is now.
Got it. And I have final question. Are there any good things coming out of the Supreme Court or lower court decisions? Is there anything that feels warm and fuzzy right now?
I mean, it's so hard to divide warmth and fuzzy.
I
had hoped that the gerrymandering cases would have been that, and instead they were nothing. I do think that criminal justice is one space where, like, you might see more good news out of the Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor, I think, is fascinating, because what I love about Sonia Sotomayor is, you know, she began her career as a prosecutor, and she wasn't like a U.S. attorney. You know, she was a line prosecutor where, like, the New York Police Department was bringing her cases, and those were the cases that she was prosecuting.
Right.
So she knows every damn trick that cops pull.
Right.
And, like, what she has decided to do now that she has the power to do something about it is say, oh, yeah, I know that trick, and I don't want you to do it anymore. I hate to say anything good about Gorsuch, but Gorsuch just hates government.
Right.
And sometimes when someone just hates government, that means that they do things that are bad for cops too.
Right, right.
So I think that there is a potential that we could see the court doing some interesting things in the criminal justice space. But, I mean, most of the news is going to be really bad.
Oh, goody. Well, I will say, I mean, Ginsburg is a classic, but Sotomayor is actually my favorite justice right now. And the fact that I have a favorite Supreme Court justice should tell you a lot about my life and the time that we live in. But yeah, I've seen some really wonderful opinions out of her. And it's heartening for me, at least, even if it's a minority opinion, it's heartening for me to see the sort of, like, because like you said, Supreme Court decisions are not as abstract or theoretical as lower court decisions a lot of the time. And so even if it's a dissenting opinion, it can make its way into the cultural lexicon. And that to me is at least heartening.
Yeah, no, what I love about Sotomayor is that she actually lives in the world.
Right.
I didn't clerk on the Supreme Court, but I clerked one level down on a federal appeals court. And I mean, it was a great job. I loved it. But what my job was that I got up every day and drove to a literal marble palace.
Right.
Like, I mean, it was just and I sat in my office and I read briefs and I wrote memos to my judge about how I think cases should come down. And then the judge read the briefs and read my memos and like read the documents that came into his room in the Marble Palace. And then, you know, a decision would come out of the chambers and the world would change. And, you know, I hope that we made good decisions while we were doing this, but we weren't living in the world.
Right.
You know, it's not like we drove out to the street corner where the crime at issue in a case happened and tried to figure out what was going on. And Sotomayor, I think, has a better grasp of how the world actually operates than anyone who sat on the court in a very long time, except for maybe Ginsburg.
Yeah, yeah. No, I completely agree with you, and I think she's great. So, Ian, thank you so much for answering my 1 million questions about the court system. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, this has been fun.
I appreciate it. So you all can follow Ian at imilheiser on Twitter. I highly suggest that you do so. And yeah, I like I said, I really appreciate it. And please let me know if anything huge breaks. I'd love to have you back on and talk about it some more.
Well, we've got two more decision days. So like I imagine there's going to be a lot of bad news coming.
I know. All right. Well, thank you again.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, Hellions, that does it for me. I hope that interview was enlightening to the process of the courts and the Supreme Court and on Flores and how this family separation policy will be moving forward in a legal sense. So thank you again to Ian, who was fantastic to interview. I had such a great time. So Varsha and I will be back here on Monday. So in the meantime, have a great weekend, raise some hell, and remember, let's all practice empathy together, because if nothing else, we could all use a little more empathy in our lives.